The episode in which advertisers are speaking as yet unknown is whether Fox News is listening from American public media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Tuesday. This one is, I believe, the 4th of April. Good as always to have you along, everybody. I am going to read you a couple of brand names. You tell me what they have in common, all right? All right, here we go. Mercedes-Benz, BMW, Hyundai. Yes, they are all car companies, but that's not the point. Those three and at least 9 other companies are pulling their ads, either current spots or planned ad buys, from the most popular show in cable news, The O'Reilly Factor on Fox News. A New York Times investigation has found Fox paid out about $13 million to settle sexual harassment claims against O'Reilly, claims that O'Reilly, it has to be said, denies, but denials that are not appeasing the money people. Marketplace's Adrian Hill gets us going.
These days, U.S. consumers expect companies to do more than just sell them stuff. They want the businesses they buy from to stand for something. Merrick Masters is a professor at Wayne State University.
They care about their stands on the environment. They care about their stands on consumer issues. They care about their stands on workplace practices.
Consumers personalize their brands. They expect them to do the right thing by society, to have a purpose. It's not always been this way. Melissa Dodd is an advertising professor at the Nicholson School of Communication at the University of Central Florida.
The case used to be that people leaned on government to sort of legislate brands.
Now she says it's flipped.
We see the consumer leaning on the brands to sort of regulate government, or maybe in this case a celebrity with some power like Bill O'Reilly.
But before you think we've got a wholesale marketers versus the establishment revolution going on here, keep in mind the number of brands that have pulled out of the show is relatively small. According to iSpot TV, some 357 companies have run spots on the O'Reilly Factor during just the first quarter of this year, spending an estimated $46.9 million. Deb Freeman is chief strategy officer at the ad agency FCB New York.
You can't enter the fray just to be opportunistic.
Sneaking back on the air, if Fox doesn't make changes, is going to be hard for these brands that are pulling their ads. Because as much as some consumers want companies to take a stand, that stand's got to be authentic. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
Attorney General Jeff Sessions is going to take another look at the consent decrees the Department of Justice has in place at police departments across the country. Agreements those departments sign on to after the DOJ finds their practices wanting, often in the wake of a high-profile shooting or accusations of racial profiling. There are societal costs to official misconduct, certainly also very real financial ones. Marketplace's Mariel Segarra has that one.
The police departments currently following consent decrees are in cities as varied as Pittsburgh, Seattle, New Orleans, Ferguson. That means the cost of complying with these agreements, which call for everything from eradicating racial profiling to hiring more officers, varies too. Maria Haberfeld teaches at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice.
It can be hundreds of thousands of dollars. It can be millions of dollars, depending on the size, depending on how many areas need to be addressed.
The federal government does not foot the bill for these changes, so the costs can pile up. Sam Walker, a retired professor of criminal justice from the University of Nebraska, Omaha, says there's a human cost and a financial cost to not having these agreements.
These departments, before consent decrees, have been paying out tens of millions of dollars in legal settlements for police misconduct.
Walker says that money could be used to hire more police officers or fund after-school programs, which can lower crime rates. The Department of Justice can't just back out of these existing agreements with police departments. Christy Lopez is a former DOJ official and teaches at Georgetown Law.
The Department of Justice would have to go into court and convince the judge that it should change the decree in the way that they want it to.
But Lopez says the DOJ might decide not to forge any new consent decrees with police departments. And that means proposals being negotiated in Chicago and Baltimore right now are up in the air. In New York, I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
Wall Street ended today higher than where it started by just a touch. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The name in the news in fashion today, well, there are two, truth be told. One is J. Crew, the fashion retailer, which you've probably heard of. The other is Jenna Lyons, who you probably haven't heard of, but who is in the news today because after 26 years at that company, most recently as president and creative director, she is leaving. We got Wall Street Journal contributor Elizabeth Holmes on the phone to give us a little context on this. Elizabeth, good to talk to you again.
Hey, Kai.
So listen, what happened with J. Crew? I mean, they used to be all that.
They sure did. They have a very loyal fan base. And the problem is that fan base has stopped shopping with them. It's a unique sort of brand in the mall landscape in that a lot of people really care about J. Crew. They have really strong feelings. They really want to shop there. They're going to the stores and they're just not finding anything for them. And it's a combination of a couple of different things. The style for sure has been off for a lot of shoppers, but also quality and price and sizing. So, they've been struggling for a couple of years now, and the departure of Jenna Lyons just shows that their struggles are going to continue.
I have to tell you, within minutes of this news breaking, I got two emails from folks here at Marketplace. One said, well, they ruined the cardigan sweater J. Crew did, and the other one said, oh, they ruined ballet flats, too.
See, those are their two staples, throw in a pencil skirt and you have a whole outfit.
Right, exactly. It's funny that you could be so strong. I mean, Michelle Obama, for crying out loud, was wearing J. Crew like 6 years ago, whatever it was.
I would say that was their really high point. Jenna really resonated with a lot of shoppers. She had this very sort of feminine, sort of embellished quality about her. She was known for wearing sequins and fur and things like that. And people really, especially women, were really attracted to that. And then as she sort of evolved and she, you know, became very popular within the high fashion set, her fashion got a little more out of reach, let's say. She went sort of a geek chic route and was known for wearing those thick framed glasses and a really bold lip. And a lot of people, while they admired that style on her, shoppers didn't necessarily think they could wear it themselves.
You know, I read a piece this morning, Quartz, I think it was, which pointed out that Jenna Lyons was more about attitude, really, than straight up fashion. Does that make sense?
She really could mix sort of a high-low look in a way that a lot of people hadn't several years ago. You know, she wore a denim shirt to the Met costume gala, and everybody sort of went nuts for that. And it's great to see that on someone else. It can be a little intimidating when you want to put it together for yourself. And when you're a retailer, you have to sell people on that look, and you have to, you know, help people think that they can pull it off, too. And I don't think a lot of shoppers thought they could.
Jenna Lyons has left, but after 26-something years. But Mickey Drexler, the CEO, is still there. What does the future hold then for J. Crew, do you think?
You know, they're lucky in that they have shoppers that really care. They have shoppers that are really rooting for them. And so I think there's still a lot of potential for the brand. You know, where they go from here will be really interesting to see. It's notable that they're not replacing her in her exact title. They're bringing up someone from the Madewell ranks who has run their women's fashion for a while now. They're not looking for a face of the brand, which I think actually is pretty smart, because when there's somebody who's so synonymous with a brand like Jenna was with J. Crew, it's hard to think of one without the other. And so when one goes in one direction, the other goes in that direction. And so I think it's wise of J. Crew to say, hey, listen, we're going to go like a lot of our competitors and just be a brand and not necessarily have a face attached to that and see how that works.
Elizabeth Holmes, she contributes to the Wall Street Journal, writes on fashion and a bunch of stuff. Elizabeth, thanks very much.
Thanks, Kai.
The conventional wisdom about a lot of Rust Belt cities in this country, and even the shorthand Rust Belt kind of gives it away, right? But the conventional wisdom is that they're done. Their economies are shot, laid low by a steady loss of manufacturing jobs. And the conventional wisdom continues. Voters in those cities and their surroundings are counting on the promises Donald Trump made, that he would get things back to the way they used to be. We've been spending a lot of time in one of those cities, Erie, Pennsylvania, since the election, for a series that we're calling The Big Promise. And while part of that Rust Belt narrative is true, in Erie, to be sure, there is more to it than just the same old story, as Marketplace's Rima Kreis reports.
Sean Fedorko stuck around his hometown just long enough to graduate from college. Then he did what a lot of young people from Erie do. He left.
It was a pretty strong narrative of get out, you know, that there wasn't going to be a lot of growth.
Eventually, he wound up in D.C., working part-time in telecommunications policy. After about a year, he was offered a temporary gig back in Erie. He thought he'd go for a few months, see his family, and he could join a co-working space with other young workers.
It seemed obvious, like everywhere would have something that did co-working. I mean, everybody has extra square footage in Erie.
But there were no co-working spaces, and this is a story about startups and entrepreneurs. So you know what happens next.
About half our people are in tech somehow. So Chris here is an animator and designer. Andrew there is a user interface and designer for web.
Fedorko is giving me a tour of his new company, Radius Cowork, Erie's first co-working space. For a couple $100 a month, freelancers and entrepreneurs can get a desk, office equipment, and a community.
So by doing that, they are able to commit their limited financial resources to marketing, to product development, to longevity.
The same goes for Fedorko, who was paying more rent for his one-bedroom apartment in D.C. than he is for this entire co-working space. Radius is part of a growing startup scene in Erie, much of it centered here in this ornate 1920s building, fittingly named the Renaissance Center. Nine floors down in the basement, Tammy Lynn Fox is busy converting a former restaurant into a culinary incubator.
So as you can see, it has that old steakhouse feel.
And that old steakhouse grease still on the walls. The place hasn't been touched in 15 years.
There's some asbestos, but, you know, we're ready to tackle it all.
Fox, who's a caterer, envisions bright tables, cabinets stocked with expensive cookware and equipment people can share.
It's going to create a low-cost space of development for locals that want to open up their own bakery, that want to open up their own cafe.
And up on the 12th floor, more remodeling.
We're still, you know, working on the space, as you can tell. This whole area will
26-year-old Jessica Yoakum is putting in a new studio for her video production company, Menagerie. Like Menage Erie. Get it? She runs it with her husband, Nick Taylor. They've come a long way since they were high school sweethearts making class videos about Shakespeare plays.
You know, there were some elements in there that carried over through the years.
I'd like to think we grew a little bit since then.
They've grown a lot. Since Menagerie opened in 2013, Yoakum and Taylor have hired a third person, launched an internship program, and built a creator studio people can rent.
It's just kind of crazy. I don't think we would have had this level of growth in a short amount of time if we were located somewhere else.
Yoakum was somewhere else, Los Angeles, but she came back to Erie because video production can be done anywhere, and Erie is cheap.
The same year that we started the business, basically, we actually bought our house.
Three bedrooms, one bath, and a yard for less than $40,000, a foreclosure and a bittersweet bargain. Young entrepreneurs like these two say they desperately want to see their hometown rebound. At a recent policy hearing, business leaders met with lawmakers to discuss that very thing. Beth Zimmer heads up the Innovation Collaborative in Erie.
Back in 2010 to 2014, just before all of this got started, we were experiencing about 200 startups per year. In addition to that, we were experiencing 260 company deaths at the same time.
She says that equation is starting to change.
We can feel the vibrancy in the more and more startups coming out of the woodwork.
But Zimmer says the real challenge is creating sustainability. Sean Fedorko, owner of Radius Cowork, has some thoughts on that, and they have very little to do with startups themselves.
If there was no Thai food in the city, no brewery, and nowhere to take my boat, why would I want to live here?
He says tax credits, hiring incentives, they're all great.
But what's even more crucial is making the place you want innovation to occur attractive for people to be.
Because you're going to want a trendy restaurant, a fun bar, a bike trail where you can commune with nature after a long day of building the new Erie. In Erie, Pennsylvania, I'm Rima Crace for Marketplace.
Tomorrow, how entrepreneurs in the small towns around Erie are trying to bring back their Main Street. Also, and perhaps coincidentally, I got a tweet today from a guy we talked to when we were in Erie back in January for a live show. It was about a video produced in part by the folks at Menagerie that Rima was talking to. It's called This Is Our Erie. It's actually pretty cool. You can see it on our website, marketplace.org. Just click mentioned on air. Coming up,
We're standing here a couple of meters below sea level, and we have our feet dry. So let's say welcome to the Netherlands.
Climate change as business opportunity. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 39 points today, about 0.2%, 20,689. For the blue chips, the NASDAQ gained 3 points, less than 0.1%, 58.98. S&P 500 up a point, just a touch, as I said earlier, 23.60. Ralph Lauren gave back 4.4% today. The firm plans a series of job cuts and store closures, including, get this, closing its flagship Fifth Avenue store in Manhattan. That cannot be good. Urban Outfitters off 3% today. Staples clipped up 9.8%. Get it? Clipped up Staples. The Wall Street Journal reported the office supplies company is talking to private equity firms about a possible sale. And you, yes, you, listening to Marketplace. If you want to get smarter about the things we talk about on this program every day,
technology, the economy, pop culture,
check out our podcast. It's called Make Me Smart. Me and Molly Wood.
We've got new episodes every week. Find us at marketplace.org/makemesmart or wherever you get your podcasts.
Follow us on Twitter for updates. I'm at Kai Rizdahl.
And I'm at Molly Wood.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We talked about geopolitical economics a little bit yesterday. The meeting this week between President Trump and Chinese President Xi Jinping. Today, kind of a corporate version of it. As part of the Obama administration's deal with Iran, the U.S. removed some economic sanctions on that country, you might remember, in return for Tehran's agreement to curb its development of nuclear technology. And that, in the way capitalism works, gets us to airplanes. Today, Boeing confirmed it has taken the first steps toward selling 30 new jets to an Iranian airline, the second agreement Boeing has made in that country. Marketplace's Jed Kim explains why aviation is leading the way into the Iranian market.
During decades of sanctions, Iranian airlines had a hard time buying new planes or even parts. That made people afraid to fly.
If you look back in the history of the last 10 years or so, there were a fair number of airplanes that crashed.
Richard Nephew is a researcher at Columbia University. He had a big hand in crafting the Obama administration's nuclear deal.
Yeah, I was the lead sanctions expert for the negotiating team.
Nephew says in the negotiations, new planes were high on the list for Iran.
It was one of the first things they mentioned to us when we met with them in Oman. It was one of the things they continued to describe to us as important throughout the comprehensive talks. This has been a primary focus of the Iranian government going back for years.
For aviation companies, Iran is attractive. It already has airports and customers who can afford to fly. Robert W. Mann Jr. is an airline industry analyst.
It's not as if you have to wait for the market to materialize. It's literally there. It's just been suppressed because of the trade sanctions.
Today's deal with Iran's Asaman Airlines and another in the works with Iran Air means thousands of jobs and billions in revenue for Boeing. Analyst Jonathan Root at Moody's says Iran is big.
All told, it's a $33 to $36 billion potential market.
Since many sanctions against Iran remain, aviation is actually one of the only U.S. industries that can sell to Iran. Now, the deals aren't done. The Trump administration still needs to sign off. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
You know who's not loving the low price of energy in this country? Everything from coal to oil. Energy-producing states, that's who. And in the way these things usually tend to go, those states have begun cutting funds for K-12 education. Marketplace's Aaron Schrank has that one.
Unlike most states, these ones rely heavily on taxes paid by energy companies to extract natural resources. Wyoming usually gets 60% of its budget revenue that way. And this month, the state became the latest to slash funding for public schools. Here's State Senator Chris Rothfuss.
I'm incredibly worried. We've done an amazing job over the last decade of improving education in Wyoming. We're at a point now where we're looking at rolling that back completely.
The long-term decline of Wyoming's coal industry has hit the state even harder than fluctuating oil prices. Recent education cuts amount to about $35 million, but Rothfuss says
there's a lot worse to come.
A $1.8 billion school funding shortfall is expected there within 5 years. It's been a tough transition from boom to bust. These states benefited hugely when prices went up and even had surpluses.
North Dakota went from first in the nation in job growth and GDP growth in 2013 and 2014 to 50th in the nation 1 year later.
Analyst Gabe Pettick at S&P Global Ratings says there's not much hope for a recovery, even if oil prices go up. They've already risen to around $50 a barrel from 30-something a year ago, but Pettick says they won't go much higher.
Any additional momentum above the $50 range would be met by an increase in oil supply, and that would exert downward pressure again on the prices.
It's not just schools on the chopping block. Some energy-dependent states are cutting spending on prisons and health care. I'm Aaron Schrank for Marketplace.
I'm going to say something now that's objectively true, but subjectively, cognitively dissonant at best. Climate change is, for some, a business opportunity. Island nations and coastal cities are going to be at great and expensive risk in the coming decades as they try to deal with rising sea levels. But the Netherlands knows a thing or two about holding off the oceans, and now the Dutch are selling that expertise in water management. From the European Desk, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
With its four giant sails flailing in the wind, a traditional Dutch windmill is at work. Inside the mill, the great clunking wooden wheels and gears are doing the job they've done for centuries, pumping and draining. Now a tourist attraction near Amsterdam, this mill is one of many reminders of this country's unceasing struggle against water.
Already for 1,000 years, the Dutch are fighting, battling the sea, building dikes, draining the land with the windmills. We're standing here a couple of meters below sea level, and we have our feet dry. So let's say welcome to the Netherlands.
Piet Dirk of the Dutch consulting firm Arcadis. He's worked on many projects around the Netherlands, pumping, draining, building sea barriers and storing water in a country that's largely below sea level. Now, increasingly, he's working abroad.
There's so many cities around the world in deltas or in coastal zones very close to the water that are in jeopardy. Millions of people in these big cities need to be protected against the impacts of floods and climate change, and the Dutch know how to do that.
The Dutch know-how extends well beyond pumping and draining. I've come to Rotterdam Harbour to see an experimental project that could help communities cope with rising sea levels, not by draining and reclaiming land, but by building on water.
The complete structure is actually floating.
Bart Rufen and his colleagues at DeltaSync designed this floating pavilion. Under a domed roof, 10,000 square feet of floor space, bobbing ever so gently by the quayside.
Yeah, you can see it here, that there's a few centimetres of movement.
Just ever so slightly up and down.
Yeah.
The base is made of polystyrene foam encased in concrete and anchored to the sea floor by two giant mooring piles. A great way to create extra space in a densely populated country where land is scarce but water plentiful. And it's not too pricey to build.
It costs around 10 to 15% more than a regular building.
That's not huge difference.
So, no, it's not a huge difference, and the water value is not as high as the land value. So that's what you can save.
Elsewhere in Rotterdam Harbour, Peter Vingerden is planning another waterborne innovation, a floating dairy farm.
We start with 40 cows, and after that we will have 6,000 chicken, and then we have a greenhouse. So we create the first food strip on the water inside the city.
He reckons the farm will be of huge interest to low-lying coastal cities that want to guarantee their food production in case their farmland is flooded. And he insists the cows will love it too.
There's a robot that keeps cleaning the floor continuously. So the cows are on a very soft and clean floor, and they love it.
They don't prefer it to grass, surely.
And they prefer the membrane floor because it's very soft, it's very good for their feet. And it's always clean, so they prefer the membrane for it. That's very funny.
As entrepreneurs sell Dutch water expertise across the globe, they're doing what the Netherlands has always done. The technology has vastly improved, but they're still profiting from environmental adversity, benefiting from curbing the sea. In the Netherlands, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Final note on the way out today, one of those retail online surveys that are kind of clickbaity, but still fun. According to the good people at Retail Me Not, there is a new favorite Easter candy this year. Reese's chocolate eggs are in the top spot. Peeps are all the way down in fifth, to which I say, about time, Peeps. Come on. All right, we got to go. The Dow up 39 points today, almost 0.2%. NASDAQ up 3 points, less than 0.1%. S&P 500 up just a single point. Tommy Andres and Raghu Manavalan are the producers on our special projects desk. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our wealth and poverty desk. Our digital team includes Ben Hethcote, Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.